whatever it was, and strike back with their help. She always had minions. But forgive me, I'm getting ahead of myself. Yes, tell me what happened with Zarachenko's computer. Elizabeth was short of stimulation, as I said, and she would lie awake at night, worrying about her mother. Agneta bled badly after the rapes, but wouldn't go to a doctor. She probably felt ashamed. Periodically she sank into deep depressions and no longer had the strength to go to work or look after the girls. Camilla despised her even more. "Mama is weak," she'd say. As I told you, in her world, to be weak was worse than anything else. Elizabeth, on the other hand, saw a person she loved, the only person she had ever loved, fall victim to a dreadful injustice. She was a child in so many ways, but she was also becoming convinced that she was the only person in the world who could save her mother from being beaten to death. She got up in the middle of the night, quietly so as not to wake Camilla, and saw the computer on the desk by the window overlooking Lundegarten. At that time, she didn't even know how to switch on a computer, but she figured it out. The computer seemed to be whispering to her, "Unlock my secrets." She didn't get far, not at first. A password was needed. Since her father was known as Zala, she tried that, and Zala 666, and similar combinations, and everything else she could think of. But nothing worked. I believe this went on for 2 or 3 nights, and if she slept at all then, it was at school or at home in the afternoon. Then one night she remembered something her father had written in German on a piece of paper in the kitchen. "Was mich nicht umbringt, macht mich stärker." What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. At the time it meant nothing to her, but she realized that the phrase was important to her father, so she tried it. That didn't work either. There were too many letters, so she tried Nietzsche, the source of the quote. And there she was. Suddenly she was in. The whole world opened up to her. Later she would describe it as a moment which changed her forever. She thrived when she overcame that barrier. She explored what was meant to stay hidden.
And Zarachenko never knew of this?
It seems not. She understood nothing at first. It was all in Russian. There were various lists and some numbers, accounts of the revenues from his trafficking operations. To this day I have no idea how much she worked out then and how much she found out later. She came to understand that her mother was not the only one made to suffer by her father. He was destroying other women's lives too, and that made her wild with rage. That is what turned her into the Lisbeth we know today, the one who hates men who hate women. Precisely. But it also made her stronger. She saw that there was no turning back. She had to stop her father. She went on with her searches on other computers, including at school, where she would sneak into the staff room. Sometimes she pretended to be sleeping over with the friends she didn't have, while in fact she stayed overnight at school and sat at the computers until morning. She started to learn everything about hacking and programming, and I imagine that it was the same as when other child prodigies discovered their niche. She was enthralled. She felt that she was born for this. Many of her contacts in the digital world began to take an interest in her even then, the way the older generation has always engaged with younger talents, whether to encourage or crush them. Many people out there were irritated by her unorthodox ways, her completely new approach, but others were impressed, and she made friends, including Plague. You know about him. She got her first real friends by way of the computer, and above all, for the first time in her life, she felt free. She could fly through cyberspace just like the Wasp. There was nothing to tie her down.
Did Camilla realize how skilled she'd become?
She must have had her suspicions. I don't know. I shouldn't speculate, but sometimes I think of Camilla as Lisbeth's dark side, her shadow figure, the evil twin. A bit, though I don't like to call people evil, especially not young women. If you want to dig into it yourself, I suggest you get in touch with Margareta Dahlgren, Camilla's foster mother after the havoc at Lundegarten. Margareta lives in Stockholm now, in Solna, I think. She's a widow and has had a desperately sad life.
In what way?
Well, that may also be of interest. Her husband, Chell, a computer programmer at Ericsson, hanged himself a short time before Camilla left them. A year later, their 19-year-old daughter also committed suicide, by jumping from a Finland ferry. At least that's what the inquest concluded. The girl had emotional problems. She struggled with her self-esteem. But Margareta never believed that version, and she even hired a private detective. Margareta is obsessed by Camilla, and, to be honest, I've always had a bit of a problem with her. I'm embarrassed to say Margareta got in touch with me straight after you published your Zalachenko story. As you know, that's when I had just been discharged from the rehabilitation clinic, and I was mentally and physically at the end of my tether. Margareta talked endlessly. She was fixated. The sight of her number on my telephone display would exhaust me, and I went to some efforts to avoid her. But now, when I think about it, I understand her more. I think she would be happy to talk to you, Mikhail.
Can you let me have her details?
I'll get them for you. Just a moment.
When Palmgren came back, he said,
"So you're sure that Lisbeth and the boy are safely tucked away somewhere?"
"I'm sure," Blomqvist said. "At least I hope I am," he thought. He stood up and embraced Palmgren. Out on Yljeholmstorget, the storm tore into him again. He pulled his coat close and thought of Salander and her sister, and for some reason also of Andre Zander. He decided to call him to find out how he was getting on with his story on the art dealer, but Zander never picked up. Chapter 24. November 23rd. Evening. Zander had called Blomqvist because he had changed his mind. Of course he wanted to go out for a beer. How could he not have taken him up on the offer? Blomqvist was his idol, and the very reason he had gone in for journalism. But once he dialed the number, he felt embarrassed and hung up. Maybe Blomqvist had found something better to do. Zander did not like disturbing people unnecessarily, least of all Blomqvist. Instead he worked on. But however hard he tried, he got nowhere. The words just would not come out right. After about an hour, he decided to take a walk, and so he tidied his desk and checked once again that he had deleted every word on the encrypted link. Then he said goodbye to Emil Granden, the only other person left in the office. Granden was 36, and had worked at both TV4's Cold Facts and Svenska Morgenposten. Last year, he had been awarded the Stora Journalist Prize for Investigative Reporter of the Year. But Zander thought, even though he tried not to, that Granden was conceited and overbearing, at least towards a young temp like him.
"Going out for a bit," Zander said.
Granden looked at him as if there was something he had forgotten to say. Then he uttered in a bored tone,
"Okay."
Zander felt miserable. It may only have been Granden's arrogant attitude, but it was more likely because of the article about the art dealer. Why was he finding it so difficult? Presumably because all he wanted to do was help Blomqvist with the Balder story. Everything else felt secondary. But he was also spineless, wasn't he? Why had he not let Blomqvist take a look at what he had written? No one could raise the level of a story like Blomqvist could, with just a few light pen strokes or deletions. Never mind. Tomorrow he would see the story with fresh eyes, and then Blomqvist could read it, however bad it might be. Zander closed the door to the office and walked out towards the lift. Further down the stairs a drama was unfolding. At first he could not make out what was going on, but there was a scrawny, hollow-eyed figure molesting a beautiful young woman. Zander froze. He had always loathed violence ever since his parents had been killed in Sarajevo. He hated fights. But his self-respect was at stake. It was one thing to run away for your own sake, but quite another to leave a fellow human being in danger. And so he rushed down the stairs, yelling, "Stop! Let her go!" At first, that seemed like a fatal mistake. The hollow-eyed man pulled out a knife and muttered some threat in English. Zander's legs nearly gave way, yet he managed to muster the last remnants of his courage and spat back like something from a B-movie.
"Hey, get lost! If you don't, you'll regret it!"
After a few seconds of posturing, the man took off. Zander and the woman were left alone in the stairwell. And that, too, was like a scene from a film. The woman was shaken and shy. She spoke so softly that Zander had to lean in close to hear what she was saying, and it took a while before he understood what had happened. The woman had been in a marriage from hell, she said, and even though she was now divorced and living with a protected identity, her ex-husband had managed to track her down and sent some stooge to harass her.
"That's the second time that foul man has thrown himself at me today," she said. Why were you up here?
I tried to get away and ran in, but it didn't help. I can't thank you enough.
It was nothing.
I'm so fed up with nasty men, she said.
I'm a nice man, he said, perhaps a little too quickly, and that made him feel pathetic. He was not in the least bit surprised that the woman did not answer, but looked down at the stairs in embarrassment. He felt ashamed of such a cheap reply. But then, just as he thought he had been rejected, she raised her head and gave him a careful smile.
I think you really might be. My name's Linda.
I'm Andre.
Nice to meet you, Andre. And thank you again.
Thank you, too.
What for?
For... He didn't finish his sentence. He could feel his heart beating. His mouth was dry. He looked down the staircase.
Yes, Andre, she said.
Would you like me to walk you home? He regretted saying that, too. He was afraid it would be misinterpreted. But instead she gave him another of her enchanting, hesitant smiles, and said that she would feel safe with him by her side, so they went out into the street and down towards Slussen. She told him how she had been living more or less locked up in a big house in Djursholm. He said that he understood. He had written a series of articles on violence against women.
"Are you a journalist?" she said.
"I work at Millennium."
"Wow,"
she said.
"Seriously? I'm a huge fan of that magazine."
"It's done a lot of good things," he said shyly.
"It really has," she said. "A while ago, I read a wonderful article about an Iraqi who had been wounded in the war and got sacked from his job as a cleaner at some restaurant in the city. He was left destitute. Today, he's the owner of a whole chain of restaurants." I cried when I read it. It was so beautifully written and inspiring.
"I wrote that," he said.
"Are you joking?" she said. "It was fantastic."
Zander was not exactly spoiled when it came to praise for his journalistic efforts, especially from unknown women. Whenever Millennium was mentioned, people wanted to talk about Mikael Blomkvist, and Zander did not object to that, but secretly he dreamed of recognition for himself too, and now this beautiful Linda had praised him without even meaning to. It made him so happy and proud that he plucked up the courage to suggest a drink at Papagallo, since they were just passing. To his delight she said, "What a good idea!" So they went into the restaurant, Xander's heart pounding. He tried to avoid looking into her eyes. Those eyes had knocked him off his feet, and he could not believe this was really happening. They sat down at a table not far from the bar, and Linda tentatively put out her hand. As he took it, he smiled and mumbled something, hardly aware of what he was saying. He looked down at his phone. Granden was calling. To his own surprise, he ignored it and turned off his ringer. For once the magazine would have to wait. He just wanted to gaze into Linda's face, to drown in it. She was so beautiful that it felt like a punch to the stomach, yet she seemed fragile, like a wounded bird. "I can't imagine why anyone would want to hurt you," he said.
"It happens all the time."
Perhaps he could understand it after all. A woman like her probably attracted psychopaths. No one else would dare ask her out. Most men would just shrivel up and feel inferior. "It's so nice to be sitting here with you," he said.
"It's so nice to be sitting here with you," she repeated, gently stroking his hand.
They each ordered a glass of red wine and started to talk. They had so much to say, and he didn't notice his mobile vibrating in his pocket, not once, but twice, which is how he came to ignore a call from Mikael Blomkvist for the first time in his life. Soon afterwards, she took his hand and led him out into the night. He did not ask where they were going. He was prepared to follow her anywhere. She was the most wonderful creature he had ever met, and from time to time she gave him a smile that made every paving stone, every breath, sound out a promise that something wonderful and overwhelming was happening. "You live an entire life for the sake of a walk like this," he thought, barely noticing the cold and the city around him. He was intoxicated by her presence, and what might await him. But maybe, he wasn't sure, there was a hint of suspicion, too. At first he dismissed these thoughts, his usual scepticism at any form of happiness, and yet he could not help asking himself, is this too good to be true? He studied Linda with a new focus, and noticed that not everything about her was attractive. As they walked past Katharina Hissen, he even thought he noticed something hard in her eyes.
He looked anxiously down at the choppy waters.
"Where are we going?"
"I have a friend with a small apartment in Mortentrotzigsgrend," she said. "She lets me use it sometimes. We could have another drink there."
That made him smile, as if it were the most wonderful idea he had ever heard. Yet he felt more and more confused. Not long ago he had been looking after her, and now she had taken the initiative. When a quick glance at his mobile told him that Blomqvist had rung twice, he felt he had to call back immediately. Come what may, he could not let the magazine down.
"I'd like that," he said, "but first I have to make a call. I'm in the middle of a story."
"No, Andre," she said,
in a surprisingly firm tone.
"You're not calling anyone. Tonight it's just you and me."
They got to Jerntorget. In spite of the storm, there were quite a few people around, and Linda stared at the ground as if she did not want to be noticed. He looked over to the right at Oosterlongarten and the statue of Evert Taube. The troubadour was standing there, immobile, holding a sheet of music in his right hand, looking up at the sky in dark glasses. Should he suggest that they meet the following day?
"Maybe," he started.
He got no further, because she pulled him to her and kissed him with a force which emptied his mind. Then she stepped up the pace again. She held his hand and pulled him to the left, into Vesterlongarten, then right into a dark alley. Was that someone behind them? No. No, the footsteps and voices he could hear came from further away. It was just him and Linda, wasn't it? They passed a window with a red frame and black shutters, and came to a grey door which Linda had some trouble opening. The key was shaking in her hand, and he wondered at that. Was she still afraid of her ex-husband and his goon? They climbed a dark stone stairway. Their footsteps echoed, and there was a faint smell of something rotten. On one of the steps past the third floor, he saw a playing card, the Queen of Spades, and he did not like that. He could not understand why. It was probably some silly superstition. He tried to ignore it and think about how great it was that they had met. Linda was breathing heavily. Her right hand was clenched. A man's laughter could be heard in the alley, not laughing at him, surely. He was just agitated. But it felt as if they were climbing and climbing and not getting anywhere. Could the house really be so tall? No, here they were. The friend lived in the attic apartment. The name on the door was Orloff. And again, Linda took out her bunch of keys. This time her hand was not shaking. Blomqvist was sitting in an apartment with old-fashioned furniture on Prostvegen in Solna, next to a large churchyard. Just as Palmgren had anticipated, Margareta Dahlgren agreed to see him at once, and even though she had sounded manic over the telephone, she turned out to be an elegant lady in her 60s. She was wearing a fashionable yellow sweater and neatly pressed black trousers. Perhaps she had had time to dress up for him. She was in high-heeled shoes, and had it not been for her restless eyes, he would have thought her to be a woman at peace with herself, despite everything.
"You want to hear about Camilla," she said.
"Especially about her life more recently, if you know anything about it," he said.
"I remember when she came to us," she said, as if she had not been listening. "My husband Chell thought we could make a contribution to society at the same time as adding to our little family. We had only one child, you see, our poor Moore. She was 14 then and quite lonely. We thought it would do her good if we took in a foster daughter of roughly the same age."
"Did you know what had happened in the Salander family?"
"We didn't have all the details, but we knew that it had been awful and traumatic, and the mother was ill and the father had suffered serious burns. We were deeply moved and were expecting to meet a girl who had fallen apart, someone who would need an incredible amount of care and affection. But do you know what arrived?"
"Tell me."
"The most adorable girl we'd ever seen. It wasn't just that she was pretty. My goodness, you should have heard her talk. She was so wise and mature, and she told such heart-rending stories about how her mentally ill sister had terrorized the family. Yes, of course, I now know how far from the truth that was, but how could we have doubted her then? Her eyes were bright with conviction, and when we said, 'How dreadful, poor you,' she answered, 'It wasn't easy, but I still love my sister. She's just sick, and now she's getting treatment.' It sounded so grown up and full of empathy, and for a while it almost felt like she was the one taking care of us. Our whole family lit up, as if something glamorous had come into our lives and made everything bigger and more beautiful, and we blossomed. Moa blossomed most of all. She began to take care of her appearance, and quite soon she became more popular at school. There was nothing I wouldn't have done for Camilla right then. And Chell, my husband, what can I say? He was a new person. He was smiling and laughing all the time, and we began to make love again, if you'll forgive my being so frank. Perhaps I should have started to worry even then. But it felt like everything had finally fallen into place for our family. For a while we were all happy, as everybody is who meets Camilla. They're happy, to start with. Then, after some time with her, you don't want to live any more.
Is it that bad?
It's horrific.
So what happened?
A poison began to spread among us. Camilla slowly took control of our family. Looking back, it's impossible to tell when the party ended and the nightmare began. It had happened so gradually and imperceptibly that we woke up one day and realized everything was ruined. Our trust, our sense of security, the very foundations of our life together. Moa's self-confidence plummeted. She lay awake at night weeping, saying she was ugly and horrible and didn't deserve to live. Only later did we find out that her savings account had been cleaned out. I still don't know how that happened. But I'm convinced Camilla blackmailed her. Blackmail came as naturally to her as breathing. She collected compromising information on people. For a long time I thought she was keeping a diary, but instead it was a catalogue of all the dirt she had on people close to her. And Chell, the bastard. You know, I believed him when he said that he'd started having problems sleeping and needed to use the bed in the basement guest room. But that was an excuse to be with Camilla. Starting when she was 16, she would sneak in there at night and have perverted sex with him. I say perverted because I got wind of what was going on when I asked about the cuts on Chell's chest. He didn't say anything then, of course, just gave me some unconvincing explanation, and somehow I managed to suppress my suspicions. But do you know what they did? In the end, Chell came clean. Camilla tied him up and cut him with a knife. He said she enjoyed it. Sometimes I even hoped it was true, strange though that may sound. I hoped she got something out of it and didn't only want to torture him, to destroy his life.
Did she blackmail him too?
Oh, yes, but I don't have the full story. He was so humiliated by Camilla that he wasn't willing to tell me the truth, even when all was lost. Chell had been the rock in our family. If we lost our way while out driving, if there was a flood, if any of us fell ill, he was the calm, sensible one. "It'll all be all right," he would say in his wonderful voice. I still fantasize about it. But after a few years with Camilla in the house, he was a wreck. Hardly dared to cross the road, looked 100 times to make sure it was safe, and he lost all motivation at work, just sat with his head hanging. One of his closest colleagues, Mats Hedlund, rang and told me in confidence that an inquiry had been set up to investigate whether Chell had been selling company secrets. It sounded crazy. Chell was the most honest man I've ever known. Plus, if he'd sold anything, where was the money? We had less than ever. His bank account was stripped bare, same with our joint account.
Forgive me for asking, but how did he die?
He hanged himself, without a word of explanation. I came home from work one day and found him swinging from the ceiling in the guest room. Yes, the same room in which Camilla had had her fun with him. I was a well-paid CFO at the time, and chances are I would have had a great career to look forward to. But after that, Moore's and my world collapsed. I won't go into it any further. You want to know what happened to Camilla. But there was no end to the misery. Moore started cutting herself and practically stopped eating. One day she asked me if I thought she was scum. "My God, darling," I replied, "how can you say something like that?" Then she told me it was Camilla, that Camilla had claimed every single person who had ever met Moa thought she was repulsive. I sought all the help I could, psychologists, doctors, wise friends, Prozac, but to no avail. One gloriously beautiful spring day, when the rest of Sweden was celebrating some ridiculous triumph in the Eurovision Song Contest, Moa jumped from a ferry, and my life ended with hers. That's how it felt. I no longer had the will to live, and spent a long time in hospital being treated for depression. But then, I don't know, somehow the paralysis and grief turned to rage, and I felt that I needed to understand what had actually happened to our family.
What sort of evil had seeped in? I started to make inquiries about Camilla, not because I wanted to see her again, not under any circumstances, but I wanted to understand her, in the same way a parent of a murder victim wants to understand the murderer.
What did you discover?
Nothing to begin with. She had covered her tracks. It was like chasing a shadow, a phantom. I don't know how many tens of thousands of kroner I spent on private detectives and other unreliable people who promised to help me. I was getting nowhere, and it was driving me crazy. I became fixated. I hardly slept, and none of my friends could bear to be with me any more. It was a terrible time. People thought I was being obsessive and stubborn. Maybe they still do. I don't know what Holger Palmgren told you. But then...
Go on.
Your story on Zalochenko was published. Naturally, the name meant nothing to me, but I started to put two and two together. I read about his Swedish identity, Carl Axel Bodin, and about his connection with Svavelsjö Motorcycle Club. And then I remembered all the dreadful evenings towards the end, after Camilla had turned her back on us. At the time, I was often woken up by the noise of motorbikes, and I could see those leather vests and that awful emblem from my bedroom window. It didn't surprise me that she mixed with those sorts of people. I no longer had any illusions about her. But I had no idea that this was the world she came from, and that she was expecting to take over her father's business interests.
And did she?
Oh, yes. In her own dirty world, she fought for the rights of women. At least for her own rights. And I know that it meant a lot to many of the girls in the club. Most of all to Kajsa Falk.
Who is she?
A lovely-looking, sassy girl. Her boyfriend was one of the leaders. She spent a lot of time at our home during that last year, and I remember liking her. She had big blue eyes with a slight squint and a compassionate, vulnerable side behind her tough exterior. After reading your story, I looked her up again. She didn't say a word about Camilla, although she was by no means unpleasant. I noticed that her style had changed. The biker girl had become a businesswoman. But she didn't talk about it. I thought I'd hit another dead end.
But it wasn't?
No. About a year ago, Kajsa looked me up of her own accord, and by then she had changed again. There was nothing reserved or cool about her. This time she was hounded and nervous. Not long after that she was found dead. Shot at Storemossen's sports centre in Bromma. When we met, she told me there had been a dispute over the inheritance after Zalochenko's death. Camilla's twin sister Lisbeth came away more or less empty-handed. Apparently she didn't even want the little that she got, while the majority of the assets fell to Zalochenko's two surviving sons in Berlin, and some to Camilla. She inherited part of the trafficking business you wrote about in your report, and that made my heart bleed. I doubt Camilla cared about those women, or felt any compassion for them, but still, she didn't want to have anything to do with those activities. She said to Kajsa that only losers bother with that sort of filth. She had a completely different, modern vision of what the organization should be doing, and after hard negotiation she got one of her half-brothers to buy her out. Then she disappeared to Moscow with her capital and some of the employees who wanted to follow her, Kajsa Falk among them.
Do you know what sort of business she was setting up?
Kajsa never got enough of an insight to understand it, but we had our suspicions. I think it was to do with those trade secrets at Ericsson. By now I'm almost certain Camilla got Kjell to steal and sell something valuable, presumably by blackmailing him. I've also found out that in her first years with us, she asked some computer geeks at school to hack into my computer. According to Kajsa, she was more or less obsessed with hacking. Not that she learned anything about it herself, not at all, but she was forever talking about the money one could make by accessing bank accounts and hacking servers and stealing information. She must have developed a business along those lines.
That sounds possible.
It was probably at a very high level. Camilla would never settle for anything less. According to Kajsa, she soon found her way into influential circles in Moscow, and among other things became the mistress of some rich, powerful member of the Duma. With him she began to forge connections with a strange crew of top engineers and criminals. Because she wound them round her little finger, she knew exactly where the weak point in the domestic economy was.
And that was?
The fact that Russia is little more than a petrol station with a flag on top. They export oil and natural gas, but manufacture nothing worth mentioning. Russia needs advanced technology.
She wanted to give them there.
At least that's what she pretended. But obviously she had her own agenda. I knew that Kesa was impressed by the way she built alliances and got herself political protection. She probably would have been loyal to Camilla forever if she hadn't become scared.
What was she scared of?
Kesa got to know a former elite soldier, a major, I believe, and just lost her bearings. According to confidential information that Camilla had access to via her lover, the man had carried out a few shady operations for the Russian government. Among other things, he had killed a well-known journalist. I presume you've heard of her, Irina Azarova. She'd taken a line against the government in various reports and books.
Oh, yes, truly a heroine. A horrible story.
Absolutely. Something went wrong in the planning. Azarova was supposed to meet a critic of the regime in an apartment on a back street in a suburb, southeast of Moscow, and according to the plan, the major was supposed to shoot her as she came out. But no one knew that the journalist's sister had developed pneumonia, and Irina had to look after two nieces, aged 8 and 10. As she and the girls walked out of the front entrance, the major shot all three of them in the face. After that, he fell into disgrace. Not that anybody was particularly bothered about the children, but public opinion was getting out of hand, and there was a risk that the whole operation would be uncovered and turned against the government. I think the major was afraid he'd be made a scapegoat. He was also dealing with a load of personal problems at the same time. His wife took off, he was left alone with a teenage daughter, and I believe there was even a possibility of his being evicted from his apartment. From Camilla's perspective, that was a perfect setup. A ruthless person whom she could use, and who found himself in a vulnerable situation.
So she got him on board.
Yes, they met. Kesa was there too, and the strange thing was that she immediately took a liking to this man. It wasn't at all what she'd been expecting, nothing like the people she knew at Svavelsha MC who were killers. He was very fit and had a brutal look about him, but he was also cultivated and polite, she said, somehow vulnerable and sensitive. Kesa could tell that he felt terrible about shooting those children. He was a murderer, a man whose specialty had been torture during the war in Chechnya, but he still had his moral boundaries. And that's why she was so upset when Camilla got her claws into him, almost literally. She dragged her nails across his chest and hissed like a cat. "I want you to kill for me." Her words were charged with sexual tension, and with the skill of the devil she awakened the man's sadism. The more gruesome his descriptions of his murders, the more excited she became. I'm not sure I understood it, but it scared Kesa to death. Not the murderer himself, Camilla. Her beauty and allure managed to bring out the predator in him.
You never reported this to the police?
I asked Kesa over and over. I told her she needed protection. She said she already had it, and she forbade me to talk to the police. I was stupid enough to listen to her. After her death, I told the investigators what I'd heard, but I doubt they believe me. It was nothing but hearsay about a man without a name in another country. Camilla was nowhere to be found in any record, and I never discovered anything about her new identity. At any rate, Kesa's murder is still unsolved.
I understand how painful this all must be for you, Blomqvist said.
You do?
I think so, he said, and was about to rest a sympathetic hand on her arm.
It was brought up short by his mobile buzzing in his pocket. He hoped it was Xander, but it was Stefan Mulder.
It took Blomqvist a few seconds to identify him as the person at the NDRE who had been in touch with Linus Brandel. "What's this about?" he said.
"A meeting with a senior civil servant, an American, who's on his way to Sweden. He wants to see you as early as possible tomorrow morning at the Grand Hotel."
Blomqvist made an apologetic gesture in Fru Dahlgren's direction. "I have a tight schedule," he said. "And if I'm to meet anybody, at the very least, I want a name and an explanation."
"The man is Edwin Needham, and it's about someone using the handle Wasp who is suspected of serious crimes."
Blomqvist felt a wave of panic. "Okay," he said. "What time?"
5 o'clock tomorrow morning would work."
"You've got to be joking."
"Regrettably, there's nothing to joke about in all this. I suggest you be punctual. Mr. Needham will see you in his room. You'll have to leave your mobile at reception, and you'll be searched."
Blomqvist got to his feet and took his leave of Margareta Dahlgren. Part 3. Asymmetric Problems. November 23rd to December 3rd.
Sometimes it is easier to put together than to put asunder. Nowadays, computers can easily multiply prime numbers with millions of digits, yet it is extremely complicated to reverse the process. Numbers with only a few hundred digits present huge problems. Encryption algorithms like RSA take advantage of the difficulties involved in prime number factorization. Prime numbers have become secrecy's best friend. Chapter 25. November 23rd to 24th. It had not taken long for Salander to identify the Roger whom August had been drawing. She had seen a younger version of the man on a website showing former actors from Revolutionstheatern in Vazastan. He was called Roger Winter. He had had a couple of major film roles at the beginning of his career, but lately had ended up in a backwater, and was now less well-known than his wheelchair-bound brother Tobias, an outspoken professor of biology who is said to have distanced himself altogether from Roger these days. Salander wrote down Roger Winter's address and then hacked into the supercomputer NSF-MRI. She also opened the program with which she was trying to construct a dynamic system for finding the elliptic curves which were most likely to do the job, and with as few iterations as possible. But whatever she tried, she was unable to get any closer to a solution. The NSA file remained impenetrable. In the end, she went and looked in on August. She swore. The boy was awake, sitting up in bed, writing something on a piece of paper, and as she came closer, she could see that he was doing more prime number factorizations. "It's no good. It's not getting us anywhere," she muttered, and when August began to rock back and forth hysterically once again, she told him to pull himself together and go back to sleep. It was late, and she decided that she should rest for a while, too. She took the bed next to his, but it was impossible to sleep. August tossed and turned and whimpered, and in the end Salander decided to say something, to try to settle him. The best she could think of was, "Do you know about elliptic curves?" Of course she got no answer. That did not deter her from giving as simple and clear an explanation as she could. "Do you get it?" she said. Still August did not reply. "Okay, then," she went on. "Take the number 3,034,267, for example. I know you can easily find its prime number factors, but it can also be done using elliptic curves. Let's take curve y equals x to the power of 3 minus x plus 4, and point p equals 1, 2 on that curve, for example." She wrote the equation on a piece of paper on the bedside table, but August did not seem to be following at all. She thought about those autistic twins she had read up on. They had some mysterious way of identifying large prime numbers, yet could not solve the simplest equations. Perhaps August was like that, too. Perhaps he was more of a calculating machine than a genuine mathematical talent. And in any case, it didn't matter right now. Her bullet wound was aching again, and she needed some sleep. She needed to drive out all her old childhood demons, which had come to life again because of the boy. It was past midnight by the time Blomquist got home, and even though he was exhausted and had to get up at the crack of dawn, he sat down at his computer and googled Edwin Needham. There were quite a few Edwin Needhams in the world, including a successful rugby player who had made an extraordinary comeback having had leukemia. There was one Edwin Needham who seemed to be an expert on water purification, and another who was good at getting himself into society photographs and looking daft. But none of them seemed right for someone who could have been involved in cracking Wasp's identity and accusing her of criminal activity. There was an Edwin Needham who was a computer engineer with a PhD from MIT, and that was at least the right line of business. But not even he seemed to fit. He was now a senior executive at Safeline, a leading business in computer virus protection, and that company would certainly have an interest in hackers. But the statements made by this Ed, as he was known, were all about market share and new products. Nothing he said rated higher than the usual clichéd sales talk, not even when he got the chance to talk about his leisure pursuits, bowling and fly fishing. He loved nature, he said. He loved the competitive aspect. The most threatening thing he seemed capable of doing was boring people to death. There was a picture of him, grinning and bare-chested, holding up a large salmon, the sort of snap which is a dime a dozen in fishing circles. It was as dull as everything else, and yet, gradually,
Longfist began to wonder whether the dullness might be the whole point. He read through the material again, and this time it struck him as something concocted, a facade. Slowly but surely he came to the opposite conclusion. This was the man. You could smell the intelligence service a mile off, couldn't you? It felt like NSA or CIA. Once again he looked at the photograph with the salmon, and this time he thought he saw something very different. He saw a tough guy putting on an act. There was something unwavering about the way he stood and grinned mockingly into the camera. At least that is what Blomqvist imagined. And again he thought of Salander. He wondered if he ought to tell her about this meeting. But there was no reason to worry her now, especially since he did not actually know anything. So instead he decided to go to bed. He needed to sleep for a few hours and have a clear head when he met Needham in the morning. Pensively he brushed his teeth and undressed and climbed into bed. He realized he was more tired than he could have imagined, and fell asleep in no time. He dreamed that he was being dragged under and almost drowned in the river Needham had been standing in. Afterwards he had a vague image of himself crawling along the riverbed, surrounded by flopping, thrashing salmon. But he cannot have slept for long. He woke with a start and the growing conviction that he had overlooked something. His mobile was lying on the bedside table, and his thoughts turned to Xander. The young man must have been on his mind all along. Linda had double-locked the door. There was nothing odd about that. A woman in her situation had to take security precautions. It still made Xander feel uncomfortable, but he put that down to the apartment, or so he tried to convince himself. It was not at all what he had been expecting. Could this really be the home of one of her girlfriends? The bed was broad, but not especially long, and both the headboard and the footboard were made of shiny steel latticework. The bedspread was black, which made him think of a bier, and he disliked the pictures on the walls, mostly framed photographs of men with weapons. And there was a sterile, chilly feel to the whole place. On the other hand, he was probably just nervous and exaggerating everything, or looking for an excuse to get away. A man always wants to kill the thing he loves. Hadn't Oscar Wilde said something like that? He looked at Linda. Never before had he seen such an extraordinarily beautiful woman, and now she was coming towards him in her tight blue dress, which accentuated her figure. As if she had been reading his mind, she said, "Would you rather go home, André?" "I do have quite a lot on my plate." "I understand," she said, kissing him. "Then you must, of course, go and get on with your work." "Maybe that will be best," he muttered, as she pressed herself against him, kissing him with such force that he had no defence. He responded to her kiss and put his hands on her hips, and she gave him a shove. She pushed him so hard that he staggered and fell backwards onto the bed, and for a moment he was scared. But then he looked at her. She was smiling as tenderly now as before, and he thought, this was nothing more than a bit of rough play. She really wanted him, didn't she? She wanted to make love with him there and then, and he let her straddle his body, unbutton his shirt, and draw her fingernails over his stomach, while her eyes shone with an intense glow, and her large breasts heaved beneath her dress. Her mouth was open. A trickle of saliva ran down her chin, and she whispered something he could not at first hear.
"Now, André," she whispered again. "Now!"
"Now?" he repeated uncertainly, and felt her tearing off his trousers. She was more brazen than he had expected, more accomplished and wildly lascivious than anybody he had met.
"Close your eyes and lie absolutely still," she said.
He obeyed, and could hear her fiddling with something, he was not sure what. Then he heard a click and felt metal around his wrists, and realized he had been handcuffed. He was about to protest. He did not really go in for that sort of thing, but it all happened so fast, with lightning speed, as if she had experience. She locked his hands to the headboard. Then she bound his feet with rope and pulled tight.
"Gently," he said. "Don't worry."
But then she gave him a look he did not like and said something in a solemn voice. He must have misheard.
"What?"
he said.
"I'm going to cut you with a knife, André," she said,
and fixed a large piece of tape across his mouth. Blomqvist was trying to tell himself not to worry. Why would anything have happened to Xander? No one, apart from Berrier and himself, knew that he was involved in protecting the whereabouts of Salander and the boy. They had been extremely careful with that piece of information, more careful than with any other part of the story. And yet, why had there been no word from him? Xander was not someone who ignored his phone. On the contrary, he normally picked up on the first ring whenever Blomqvist called, but now there was no way of getting hold of him, and that was strange, wasn't it? Or maybe... Again, Blomqvist tried to convince himself that Xander was busy working and had lost track of time, or in the worst case, had dropped his mobile. That was probably all it was. But still, after all these years, Camilla had appeared out of nowhere. Something must be going on. And what was it Boblansky had said? We live in a world in which paranoia is a requirement. Blomqvist reached for the telephone on the bedside table and called Xander again. He got no answer this time either, so decided to wake their new staff member, Emil Granden, who lived near Xander in Roda Berien in Vazastan. Granden sounded less than enthusiastic, but promised to go over to Xander's right away to see if he was there. 20 minutes later, he rang back. He'd been banging on Xander's door for a while, he said, and he definitely wasn't at home. Blomqvist got dressed and left his apartment, hurrying through a deserted and storm-lashed Södermalm district up to the magazine offices at Utgatan. With any luck, he thought, Xander would be lying asleep on the sofa. It would not be the first time he had nodded off at work and not heard the telephone. That would be the simple explanation. But Blomqvist felt more and more uneasy. When he opened the door and turned off the alarm, he shivered, as if expecting to find a scene of devastation, but after a search of the premises he found no trace of anything untoward. All the information on his encrypted email program had been carefully deleted, just as they had agreed. It all looked as it should. But there was no Xander lying asleep on the office sofa, which was as shabby and empty as ever. For a short while Blomqvist sat there lost in thought. Then he rang Granden again.
"Emil," he said, "I'm sorry to harass you like this in the middle of the night, but this whole story has made me paranoid."
"I can understand that.
I couldn't help hearing that you sounded a bit stressed when I was talking about Andre. Is there anything you haven't told me?"
"Nothing you don't already know," Granden said.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that I've spoken to the Data Inspection Authority, too."
"What do you mean, you too?"
"You mean you haven't..."
"No!"
Blomqvist cut him short and heard Granden's breathing at the other end of the line become laboured. There had been a terrible mistake.
"Out with it, Emil, and fast," he said.
"So..."
"Yes,
I had a call from Alina Robertson at the Data Inspection Authority. She said that you'd spoken and she agreed to raise the level of security on your computer given the circumstances. Apparently the recommendations she'd given you were wrong, and she was worried the protection would be insufficient. She said she wanted to get hold of the person who'd arranged the encryption for you ASAP."
"And what did you say?"
"That I knew nothing about it, except that I'd seen Andre doing something at your computer."
"So you said she should get in touch with Andre?"
"I happened to be out at the time and told her that Andre was probably still in the office. She could ring him there," I said. That was all.
"Jesus, Emil!"
"She sounded really..."
"I don't care how she sounded. I just hope you told Andre about the call."
"Maybe not right away. I'm pretty snowed under at the moment, like all of us."
"But you told him later?"
"Well, he left the office before I got a chance to say anything."
"So you called him instead?"
"Absolutely, several times. But..."
"Yes?"
"He didn't answer."
"Okay," Blomqvist said, his voice ice cold.
He hung up and dialed Bublansky's number. He had to try twice before the chief inspector came to the telephone. Blomqvist had no choice but to tell him the whole story, except for Salander and August's location. Then he called Berrier. Salander had fallen asleep, but she was still ready for action. She was in her clothes, with her leather jacket and her boots on. She kept waking up, either because of the howling storm or because August was moaning in his sleep. But each time she dozed off, she had short, strangely realistic dreams. Now she was dreaming about her father beating her mother, and she could feel that fierce old rage from her childhood. She felt it so keenly that it woke her up again. It was 3:45 a.m., and those scraps of paper on which she and August had written their numbers
were still lying on the bedside table. Outside, snow was falling, but the storm seemed to have calmed, and nothing unusual could be heard, just the wind rustling through the trees. She felt uneasy, and at first she thought it was the dream lying like a fine mesh over the room. Then she shuddered. The bed next to her was empty. August was gone. She shot out of bed without making a sound, grabbed her Beretta from the bag on the floor, and crept into the large room next to the terrace. The next moment she breathed a sigh of relief. August was sitting at the table, busy with something. Without wanting to disturb him, she leaned over his shoulder and saw that he was not writing new prime-number factorizations or drawing fresh scenes of abuse. He was sketching chess squares, reflected in the mirrors of a wardrobe, and above them could be made out a threatening figure with his hand outstretched. The killer was taking shape. Zalander smiled, and then she withdrew. Back in the bedroom she sat on the bed, removed her pullover and the bandage, and inspected the bullet wound. It didn't look good, and she still felt weak. She swallowed another couple of antibiotic pills and tried to rest. She may even have gone back to sleep for a few moments. She was aware of a vague sensation that she had seen both Zala and Camilla in her dream, and the next second she became aware of a presence, though she had no idea what. A bird flapped its wings outside. She could hear August's labored breathing in the kitchen. She was just about to get up when a scream pierced the air. By the time Blomqvist left the office in the early morning hours to take a taxi to the Grand Hotel, he still had no news of Xander. He tried again to persuade himself that he had been overreacting, that any moment now his colleague would call from some friend's place. But the worry would not go away. He was vaguely aware that it had started snowing again, and that a woman's shoe had been left lying on the sidewalk. He took out his Samsung and called Zalander on the red phone app. Zalander did not pick up, and that did not make him any calmer. He tried once more and sent a text from his Threema app. "Camilla's after you. Leave now." Then he caught sight of a taxi coming down from Hökensgata. The driver gave a start when he saw him. At that moment, Blomqvist looked dangerously determined. It did not help that he failed to respond to the driver's attempts to chat. He just sat back there in the darkness, his eyes bright with worry. Stockholm was more or less deserted. The storm had abated, but there were still white-crested waves on the water. Blomqvist looked across to the Grand Hotel on the other side and wondered if he should forget about the meeting with Mr. Needham and drive straight out to Zalander instead, or at least arrange for a police car to swing by. No, he couldn't do that without warning her. Another leak would be disastrous. He opened the Threema app again and tapped in, "Shall I get help?" No answer. Of course there was no answer. He paid the fare and climbed out of the taxi, lost in thought. By the time he was pushing through the revolving doors of the hotel, it was 4:20 in the morning. He was 40 minutes early. He had never been 40 minutes early for anything, but he was burning up inside, and before going to the reception desk to hand in his mobiles, he called Beria. He told her to try to get hold of Zalander and keep in touch with the police. "If you hear anything, call the Grand Hotel and ask for Mr. Needham's room."
"And who's he?"
"Someone who wants to meet me."
"At this time of day?"
Needham was in room 654. The door opened, and there stood a man reeking of sweat and rage. There was about as much resemblance to the figure in the fishing photograph as there would be between a hungover dictator and his stylized statue. Needham had a drink in his hand and looked grim, unkempt, and a little bit like a bulldog.
"Mr. Needham," Blomqvist said.
"Ed," Needham said, "I'm sorry to haul you over here at this ungodly hour, but it's urgent."
"So it would seem," Blomqvist said dryly.
"Do you have any idea what I want to talk to you about?"
Blomqvist shook his head and sat down on a sofa. There was a bottle of gin and some small bottles of Schweppes tonic on the desk next to it.
"No, why would you?" Needham said. "On the other hand, it's impossible to know with guys like you. I've checked you out. You should know that I hate to flatter people. It leaves a bad taste in my mouth. But you're pretty outstanding in your profession, aren't you?"
Blomqvist gave a forced smile.
"Can we just get to the point?" he said.
"Just relax. I'll be crystal clear. I assume you know where I work?"
"Not exactly," he answered truthfully.
"In Puzzle Palace, Sigint City. I work for the World Spittoon."
The NSA.
Damn right. Do you have any idea how fucking insane you have to be to mess with us, Miguel Blomqvist, do you?
I have a pretty good idea, he said.
And do you know where I think your girlfriend really belongs?
No.
She belongs behind bars. For life.
Blomqvist gave what he hoped was a calm, composed little smile. But in fact his mind was spinning. Did Salander hack the NSA? The mere thought terrified him. Not only was she in hiding, with killers on the hunt for her, was she also going to have the entire U.S. intelligence services descend on her? It sounded... well, how did it sound? It sounded totally off the wall. One of Salander's abiding characteristics was that she never did anything without first carefully analyzing the potential consequences. She did not follow impulses or whims, and therefore he could not imagine she would take such an idiotic risk if there was the slightest chance of being found out. Sometimes she put herself in harm's way, that was true, but there was also a balance between costs and benefits. He refused to believe that she had gotten herself into the NSA only to allow herself to be outwitted by the splenetic bulldog standing in front of him.
"I think you're jumping to conclusions," he said. "Dream on, dude. But you might be able to save your girlfriend's skin if you promise to help me with one or two things."
"I'm listening," he said.
"Peachy! Let me begin by asking for a guarantee that you won't quote me as your source."
Blomqvist looked at him in surprise. He had not expected that.
"Are you some kind of whistleblower?" "God help me, no. I'm a loyal old bloodhound."
"But you're not acting officially on behalf of the NSA.
You could say that right now I have my own agenda, sort of doing my own thing. Well, how about it?"
"I won't quote you."
"Great. I also want to make sure we agree that what I'm going to tell you now will stay between us. You might be wondering why the hell I'm telling a fantastic story to an investigative journalist only to have him keep his trap shut."
"Good question."
"I have my reasons. And I trust you. Don't ask me why. I'm betting that you want to protect your girlfriend, and you think the real story is elsewhere. Maybe I'll even help you with that, if you're prepared to cooperate."
"That remains to be seen," Blomqvist said stiffly.
"Well, a few days ago we had a data breach on our intranet, our NSA net. You know about that, don't you?"
"More or less."
"NSA net was created after 9/11, to improve coordination between our own intelligence services and those in other English-speaking countries, known as the Five Eyes. It's a closed system with its own routers, portals, and bridges, and it's completely separate from the rest of the Internet. We administer our signals intelligence from there via satellite on fiber-optic cables, and that's also where we have our big databases and store classified analyses and reports, from moray-rated documents, the least sensitive, all the way up to Umbra Ultra Top Secret, which even the President of the United States isn't allowed to see. The system is run out of Texas, which, by the way, is idiotic, but it's still my baby. Let me tell you, Mikael Blomqvist, I worked my ass off. Hammered away at it day and night so that no fucker could misuse it, never mind hack it. Every single little anomaly sets my alarm bells ringing. Plus, there's a whole staff of independent experts monitoring the system. These days you can't do a goddamn thing online without leaving footprints. At least, that's the theory. Everything is logged and analyzed. You shouldn't be able to touch a single key without it triggering a notification. But...
someone did.
Yes. And maybe I could have made my peace with it. There are always weak spots. We can always do better. Weak spots keep us on our toes. But it wasn't just the fact that she managed to get in. It was how she did it. She forced our server and created an advanced bridge and got into the intranet via one of our systems administrators. That alone was a damn masterpiece. But that wasn't all. Then the bitch turned herself into a ghost user.
A what?
A ghost. She flew around in there without anyone noticing.
Your alarm bells didn't go off?
That damn genius introduced a Trojan unlike anything else we knew, because otherwise our system would have identified it right away. The malware then kept upgrading her status. She got more and more access and soaked up highly classified passwords and codes and started to link and match records and databases, and suddenly, bingo.
Bingo what?
She found what she was looking for, and then she stopped wanting to be invisible. She wanted to show us what she'd found, and only then did my alarm bells go off, exactly when she wanted them to.
And what did she find?